Mrs. Easley will tell you a little bit about what caused the NWRO to finally get themselves together and organize a group here in the Champaign-Urbana area. Mrs. Easley?
Thank you, Mr. Henderson. My name is Elsie Easley, and I'm a community worker for Northeast Champaign-Urbana. High is a different thing for different folks. I don't smoke pot, but I'm off a high tonight. I'm high because Champaign-Urbana, Northeast End, is in the process of formulating a welfare rights organization. That means that poor people are going to finally get some political pull in this community. This past Thursday, to my knowledge, seven ADC checks were stolen off of a mail truck. The Department of Public Aid did not notify those recipients about their checks being stolen, nor did they notify them of how the checks were stolen. Some of the recipients received the information, as I always say, through the grapevine. When I found out that there were checks stolen, I began to try and get those people together. Our local food conspiracy had some surplus food that they gave us that was distributed at my home on Saturday afternoon. I got the people there mainly to distribute the food, and it was to take place at 1 o'clock, 1:30, where we ended up there until 6, and the people felt that that food just weren't enough for them. They wanted to do something else. So we called the Urbana Police Department out to tell us whether or not that postman was robbed, whether they just broke in the truck and took the checks, or whether he gave them away. And we didn't get any satisfaction. So at 10 o'clock this morning, 13 recipients and I went into Mr. Vernon Fitch's office, and we gave to each caseworker and social worker or supervisor a flyer saying that we weren't there to talk to them. We didn't want them pulling us off in no corners talking to the recipients individually. We wanted to talk to their boss, Vernon Fitch. And we told them in that flyer that we felt that information perhaps had not been gotten to them, and trying to justify the reasoning for them not contacting recipients. Then we went to Mr. Fitch with 5 demands, and in the end we included the 6th demand. Those demands were that checks be made available immediately to recipients. Mr. Fitch could not comply immediately, but the recipients will receive their checks on Thursday. We ask that food stamps be given to recipients immediately. Mr. Fitch said that at 2 p.m. this afternoon, he would have food orders released for those recipients who lost their checks, and which it did happen. We did get the food orders. We also asked that Mrs. Pearline Brown, who did not get her check in January, get her check immediately. Mrs. Brown supposedly will get her check on Thursday, along with the check that was stolen from her on Thursday. Our other demand was that recipients in Champaign County stop being treated as numbers and be treated as human beings. So rather than give us a number to write on our checks when we get it cash, put a picture on that identification card so people can stop being referred to as numbers, but as people. Mr. Fitch will try to comply with this demand. We also ask that Mr. Fitch set up a system and employ someone to be on call 24 hours a day, so when ADC recipients have a crisis, someone can at least respond to their needs. In that demand also included an emergency telephone line into the Department of Public Aid. Mr. Fitch would think about that. Then the sixth demand came when I asked Mr. Fitch if it was possible that welfare recipients could give his staff in-service training. He's going to talk to his staff about that. We intend to have that demand met as soon as possible because we feel that it's a need for some of those social workers down there to know what oppression is all about. I know that there are a lot of people here tonight from Jane Addams, is that the proper name? Jane Addams School of Social Work. And we feel that when you need ADC recipients to clue you in on poorness, we do now have a local welfare rights organization that will be able to teach you something that Jane Addams ain't gonna teach you, because Jane Addams School of Social Work don't know nothing about poorness. They don't know nothing about hungry babies, because they ain't never been on the north end of Champaign or Bannon and seen any. We would also like to invite the people in the university community that's been talking about Friends of Welfare Rights to contact us. We would like for our phone contact, to go through the Black Coalition. That number is 356-0065. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mrs. Easley. Well, it's my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. George Wiley. Dr. George Wiley is an educator by profession and probably an agitator by avocation. Dr. Wiley was raised in the state of Rhode Island, where he pursued his BS degree, and then went to Cornell, where he received his PhD in 1957 in organic chemistry. He has taught at the University of California in Berkeley, and then most recently was an associate professor of chemistry at Syracuse University before leaving the university to join CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, in 1965. He stayed with that organization for a year and then founded the Poverty Rights Action Center in Washington, D.C. And the purpose of this organization was to organize poor people around the problems that directly affected them. And out of this organization came the National Welfare Rights. The National Welfare Rights Organization is a nationwide organization of welfare recipients and other poor people. It is composed of over 700 affiliated local welfare organizations in 200 cities and in all of the 50 states. The goals of the organization are to fight for an adequate income, dignity, justice, and democracy for the poor people of all races. Dr. Wiley will tell you about his work and about those people he is associated with. Dr. Wiley.
I'd like to tell you a little bit tonight about welfare itself and about the history of the struggle for welfare rights in this country. I think you have to understand a little bit about the background of the welfare system, which I dare say most people in this country, and probably most of you, do not understand and do not know even the most elementary facts about the system, because there has grown up such an enormous mythology about the welfare system and about welfare recipients, which is really basically developed so people can rationalize the poor treatment that is given to recipients in the welfare system. For example, the most fundamental thing about welfare that is misunderstood is the notion that there are large numbers of able-bodied people on welfare who could be working if only they would have the initiative to go out and get a job. In fact, the recipients of public assistance in this country are very, very carefully and thoroughly screened to absolutely see to it that nobody who could possibly work can get any welfare. And for the country to then turn around and assert, after they have deliberately established the programs so that able-bodied potential workers cannot get welfare, and then to go out and say that there are all these able-bodied people on welfare and not working, is an indication of the kind of hypocrisy that goes on around the welfare system. Let me outline the basic programs that make up public welfare in the United States, of which there are basically five different programs. We call them categorical programs. First of all, the reason for having categorical programs, as you will see, is a design to ensure that potential workers do not receive any welfare. The first category is aid to the aged. In the aid to the aged category, of which there are about 2 million recipients in the United States, is composed only of people over 65 years of age. You cannot qualify for aid to the aged unless you are 65 years of age, and then you must be destitute of other resources or other potential means of support. For example, if you have retirement or pension or Social Security or savings or other means of supporting yourself, then you may not receive public assistance under Aid to the Aged program. Second is the aid to the permanently and totally disabled, of which there are about 900,000 persons receiving assistance under this program. Aid to the permanently and totally disabled is just what it says. If you are not permanently and totally disabled, that is to say, the disability must be such not only that you cannot work at the present time, but you must be certified by a panel of the welfare department's doctors that there is no potential of your ever working in the future before you qualify for aid to the permanently and totally disabled. And if your disability is neither permanent nor total, that is to say, if you have less than a total disability, you are ineligible to receive any assistance under that program. The third program is Aid to the Blind, which is a very small program, about 80,000 recipients nationally. A few blind people can and do work. And, of course, there is the Lighthouse and various kind of programs and rehabilitation programs, and we know that some blind people do work. I pass over this program quickly, however, because it is, one, a very small program, and, two, because there is certainly no controversy about the program. It is not a program where there's a lot of people being hung up because there are all these blind people living off the dole. The fourth program, and to some degree the fifth program, are the controversial ones. The fourth program is aid to families with dependent children. In this program is broken down basically into two parts, but the major part of the program is only for families which are denied parental support by virtue of the death of one parent, the disability, the total disability of a parent, the absence of the parent who would be the breadwinner from the home, or in a small number of cases that I'll speak of separately, if the parent is chronically unemployed and therefore cannot find work. It is this small group that is the only significant number of employable persons on the welfare rolls, but I will point out how that is a very small program. The largest number of people in the Aid to the Families of Dependent Children program are children. They are the children of the AFDC mothers. AFDC consists at the present time of about 9.5 million persons. I might say that this 9.5 million persons is up from something like 3.5 million persons at the time the welfare rights movement came into existence 4.5 years ago. And there has been a precipitous rise in the number of people receiving aid under this program, and that precipitous rise is directly related to the organization and the struggle of basically of AFDC mothers for adequate income and for resources to support their children. Of these families, of which there are about 2.5 million at the present time, these 2.5 million AFDC families are families where they are denied parental support of one of the families, of one of the parents, and who is left is an AFDC mother, either with a dead or deserted husband or a totally disabled one. So what we have here is a large population of people where there is a single parent family, usually where the mother does not have a high degree of education. In the majority of cases, about 60%, where the mothers are either black or Puerto Rican or Chicano in that program and suffer heavy discrimination in the job market. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, these are mothers who have no daycare arrangement or no child care arrangement. There's no place and no way for their children to be cared for while they work. There is only a very tiny amount of daycare facilities available, especially daycare facilities available for working mothers. And I should mention that the daycare facilities that are available either charge an amount of money, or if they are public facilities, the cost of maintaining these daycare facilities averages, and this is simply a national average number, it averages about $1,500 per year per child to maintain a child in the daycare center. Well, to do the arithmetic, if you had four children to place in a daycare center, that's $6,000 a year that it costs to maintain the children in daycare, and you'd have to have a whopping good job to either pay for the daycare, simply pay, earn enough to pay for the daycare, or the government would have to be paying out a very substantial amount of money to support your children in the daycare while you worked in a conventional job. The result is that for most of these single-parent welfare families, to think that they could support themselves through work and therefore take themselves off the public rolls is really makes no sense whatsoever. And that the only significant way for them to have an adequate income is for a substantial program such as AFDC or hopefully a better program to subsidize them and give them the basic income they need for their families. Moreover, for the country not to regard the nurturing of children as significant work for which a mother should be compensated, or for which the mother should be compensated adequately to meet at least the basic needs of the children. And in fact, when you think about it, the largest number of jobs that might be available to such AFDC mothers are jobs such as domestic work, to go and clean the houses and take care of the children of somebody else's family. And this, of course, is regarded as a legitimate form of employment for an AFDC mother or for a poor person, whereas taking care of her own children is not regarded as a legitimate form of employment for which she should be compensated. That simply is one of the kinds of contradictions then that we have in our society. Then there is a small part of the AFDC program which extends benefits to intact families where there is an unemployed parent, where there is a two-parent family, but where one of the parents is unemployed. In this program, there are only about 100,000 families, about 100,000 families in the total program. About 500,000 people total are in this part of the program. This is where your employable people are to be found. Now, these families, the vast majority, in fact, two-thirds of these families live in three states, New York, California, and West Virginia. Of these families in New York, California, and West Virginia, they are all in areas of very high unemployment. They are all people who have been certified and recertified that there is no job available for them. And if there were a job available for them, they would be struck immediately from the welfare rolls. That is to say, if such a person refuses to apply for a job or refuses to take a job when offered in any of those states, he is immediately struck from the welfare rolls as being ineligible to receive assistance. Finally, the fifth program, and I might mention all of these programs, these four programs that I have mentioned, are federal programs. They are programs where a portion of the money comes from the federal government. They are run under Title IV of the Social Security Act, which provides for public assistance for people who fit into those four categories: aid to the aged, aid to the permanently and totally disabled, aid to the blind, and aid to families with dependent children. The fifth program is really a catch basket kind of program called general assistance. It gets no federal money, it is subject to no federal regulation, and it is simply a program that some states or some counties run as they see fit, where they aid people if they want to, who usually only on an emergency basis, usually only for a short period of time, and always, underscore, always, with tremendous screening to make sure that no able-bodied potential worker gets any. The most people in these programs, and of all of the general assistance programs put together, there is something under 1 million people receiving assistance in them, all of them put together across the country in general assistance. These programs generally are the ones who catch adults, usually between 45 and 65, who are sufficiently disabled so that they really can't work, even though they never got certified as being permanently and totally disabled. Or they are people who didn't fit the other categories and obviously are entitled to some kind of assistance and obviously have very desperate kinds of needs. And in very, very few cases can you ever find anybody who could conceivably work. Now, I go through that in great detail, knowing that I am in the zone of high risk of welfare recipients being accused of being lazy, shiftless, and unwilling and unresponsive in going to work. And I go through this documentation because you only need to think of how many times you have heard people talk about the chiselers, the lazy people sitting back there on welfare. Wouldn't it be nice if everybody could get a check for doing nothing like welfare recipients? And I go through this carefully to demonstrate to you by the facts that there are not all of those lazy, loafing, chiseling people out there receiving assistance. In fact, our welfare system can best be understood, and I would contend it can only be understood, on the principle that it is designed to screen out any conceivable person that has any conceivable means of supporting himself. It is not designed for providing adequately for the needs of poor people. It is not designed for helping people and oriented toward helping people who do not have an adequate income. But the total operation and all of the contradictions, all of the harassment, all of the injustices, all of the bureaucracy, all of the red tape of the welfare system can be understood if you understand that the general public attitude toward welfare is that the public intends to deny assistance to every conceivable person they can possibly deny it to, and the public intends to give the absolute least amount of assistance that can possibly be given, and without too severe a strain on the consciences of the people who are doing the giving. That is the basic premise of the welfare system. And the fact that we have such a terribly inadequate welfare system, and let me simply recite a few facts in relating to its inadequacies. The Bureau of Labor Statistics did surveys to see what it took to maintain a family of four in reasonable health and decency in an urban environment in the United States. And based on those surveys, it is easy to deduce that it would take in 1969 $5,500 for a family of four of net income, net spendable income, to have the basic food, clothing, shelter, transportation, and incidental health care needs. I am not counting the major health care needs. We're assuming a free health care is available in that. It would take about $5,500 for a family of four, and based on 1971 standards, $6,500 for a family of four when you extrapolate to 1971. The official federal definition of poverty, a level, I might mention, that bears no relationship to what it actually takes to live, but which is simply an index designed to measure all of those, to at least measure a level below which everyone is desperately poor. That level is, which is arbitrarily defined and arbitrarily set up, is set at approximately $3,700 a year for a family of four. The average welfare payment in the United States is approximately $2,500 for a family of four. And as you know, President Nixon, in all seriousness, and presumably to help poor people, is proposing a federal program of his so-called family assistance plan designed to set a federal income floor of $1,600 a year for a family of four. Now, I recite those statistics to show that the present welfare system is not designed to deal adequately with the needs of people on welfare. It is simply not designed to do that. Nor is the so-called welfare reform that President Nixon is proposing designed to do that. Both the present welfare system and President Nixon's family assistance plan are based on this faulty premise of public stinginess, which attempts to see to it that the fewest number of people get the smallest possible amount of assistance. That the present welfare system is a failure is obvious. But it has only become obvious to the general public in proportion to the fact that welfare recipients have begun to organize, and through their organized activity have exposed its deficiencies and its contradictions. I might say that all of the evils of the welfare system, save one, have been with us always. And the one problem in the welfare system that is causing welfare to be a national debate is the fact that so many poor people are getting it. Do you understand that? The problem with welfare that is causing the national debate is so many poor people are getting it. That is the problem. And the solution that is being offered is a solution which is designed to see to it that there is a limit set on how many poor people are going to get welfare. Now that fact, and you only have to read President Nixon's speech when he introduced the Family Assistance Plan on August 8, 1969, and you only have to examine the rhetoric of his State of the Union message when he reintroduced so-called welfare reform as his top priority for the 92nd Congress, to understand that what is driving President Nixon to propose welfare reform legislation is so many poor people are getting more money from welfare than people in power intended for them to have. Example, you only have to read, and in the same week, about 3 weeks ago, both Time, Newsweek, and U.S. News and World Report all wrote cover stories about the welfare crisis. And the central thread of all of those stories, as the central thread of the theme of President Nixon's statements about welfare, are that welfare is a monstrous failure because the welfare rolls are rising so precipitously and the welfare costs are going up so drastically and dramatically, and basically something has to be done about this horrendous system. Now, welfare has always been inadequate for poor people. The welfare bureaucracy has always been there clamping down and harassing them. Welfare system has always destroyed the dignity of poor people. The welfare system has always destroyed initiatives of poor people. And the welfare system has always been constructed in such a way as to be destructive of family life, by the various intrusions into the affairs and invasions of privacy and in every possible way undermining the dignity of the male head of household. Now, the women's liberation people may be wanting to cut my throat about that, but if you want to talk and you want to be concerned about the fact that in the black community there is such a high incidence of desertion among black heads of households, the fact of the matter is, conditions as they are, where there are not jobs for the men to be able to support their families, and conditions being as they are, that the only way in the majority of states that people can get any welfare for their families is for the man to be gone, or in states where there is a program for unemployed parents, the family can only get welfare when it has subjected itself to the most degrading and humiliating kind of scrutiny of its affairs and the most degrading kind of harassment of the father in the household. Now that situation is one which is not going to be corrected by the Family Assistance Plan. Indeed, the Family Assistance Plan is set in such a way that it is going to create a larger and more complicated bureaucracy than the present welfare system, and it is going to create a larger and more complicated bureaucracy precisely because President Nixon buys the basic false premise of the welfare system, that it should be designed to get people off as soon as possible, that is to say, to give as little money as possible to as few people as possible. And if you are going to have a system of that kind, then you must police it exhaustively, you must investigate the recipients in detail, and you must put every conceivable pressure and harassment upon them to force them to accept any job offer at the earliest possible date. And such a system is one that is clearly going to be destructive of family stability, is clearly going to be one that is harder on families and destructive of basic family life. Furthermore, the Nixon Family Assistance Plan, so-called, and we've coined the term Family Destruction Plan for the Nixon Plan, has in it a forced work provision which is more onerous than the forced work provisions provided in the 1967 amendments to the Social Security Act, which were widely recognized at the time as some of the most repressive things ever introduced into the welfare system since it was established in 1935. Those forced work requirements would require every person on welfare, every person in the family assistance plan, to register for work and to accept any offer of employment, no matter what the wages or working conditions might be. Now, this is a wonderful welfare program if you're an employer, because it ensures that there always is going to be a cheap supply of labor. There is always a population that can be forced to work under any working conditions and for literally any wages. The only wage protection, it says, they must pay the minimum wage where applicable, or the prevailing wage where there is no minimum wage, or where the prevailing wage is higher. Now, in a lot of jobs, such as in domestic work, and such as in laundries in many places, and such as in the fields and in the sweatshops in the South, there is no minimum wage protection. And the prevailing wages are like $3 a day to chop cotton in Mississippi. The prevailing wages are 75 cents an hour in the fields in California, and in the fields in Wisconsin and Michigan, where many of the migrant labor streams come up. And the prevailing wages for domestic work are 50, 75, and $1 an hour in many communities. And welfare mothers are going to be asked and are going to be forced to go out and accept those kinds of jobs under pain of being cut off welfare. And when they are offered a job cleaning somebody's kitchen or john at 75 cents an hour and they refuse, they then become ineligible to receive their public assistance. Now, we call that repression. We call that an attack on poor people. We do not call that a welfare reform. But that is what you have in the Nixon Family Destruction Plan. You also have a plan where the basic rights of poor people are undermined, where the basic grant levels, as inadequate as they are in most states, can be reduced by a number of loopholes and devices which are offered to the states, which permits them to reduce their basic cost standards and their basic grant levels from what they are at the present time. This is the kind of welfare reform that's being discussed in the Congress by President Nixon at the present time. And needless to say, we in the welfare rights organizations, an organization composed of welfare recipients and other poor people, we in the welfare rights organization are totally opposed to the Nixon Family Destruction Plan. We in the welfare rights organization are furthermore opposed to all welfare reforms, so-called, which do not make a commitment to adequate income for poor people. About 4.5 years ago, there began a national movement, a nationwide grassroots movement of poor people to organize around the basic problems that affected them. This movement began in the state of Ohio, where in that state, the state of Ohio was paying welfare recipients 70% of what the state itself defined as the minimum level necessary for health and decency. And that level, the level the state defined, was already below the poverty level, and yet the state was only paying 70% of that amount of money. In the state of Ohio, some welfare recipients decided that they would start organizing a protest to protest against the inadequacy of those welfare grants. And they devised to conduct a march from Cleveland to Columbus, a distance of 150 miles. And they would walk, a small band of about 30 welfare recipients, decided that they would walk this distance to dramatize the fact that at that time the state of Ohio had a $30 million budget surplus, and yet it was unwilling to appropriate enough money to pay recipients 100% of need. On the final day of that walk, on June 30th, 1966, the welfare recipients from across the country, mobilized by our tiny fledgling organization, the Poverty Rights Action Center, which was an organization consisting of four people, myself and three others, who were fugitives from the civil rights movement, who had decided that the most basic issue confronting black people in this country were the economic issues, and that the failure of this country to yield the 40 acres and the mule that had been talked about around the time of so-called emancipation, the failure of this country to give us the 40 acres and the mule were at the root cause of many of the problems that we had. And that the only way we were going to be able to get more money into the black community was for us to be able to organize a grassroots organization of poor black people who had the problem of inadequate income, who were willing to wage a whole series of struggles around changing their economic conditions. We also were clear that we were not going to get liberation for poor people by a cataclysmic, sweeping, single-stroke federal legislation. For we had had the Civil Rights Act of 1964, we had had the Voter Rights Act of 1965, which had delivered hollow victories for black people, and which had left black people still in a condition of second-class citizenship, and still in a condition of economic servitude. I might mention that the welfare system throughout the history of this country, since emancipation, has been one of the fundamental instruments for keeping black people in economic servitude. The welfare system in the South, and in many senses in the North, is designed simply to keep a population in a holding pattern. It is designed to simply sustain life until such time as those human beings are needed to chop the cotton, to hoe the corn, to drive the tractors, to nurse the babies, to swap the johns, or to do whatever shit work this society has in store for them. And in periods when there is no employment, then we give them this meager subsistence. And there is a consistent pattern, particularly throughout the South, of every time cotton harvesting season would come around, all welfare payments would be stopped for black people in that area, and everybody that came in to find out what happened to their check would be told there was plenty of work out in the cotton fields, and that's where they should go to get there and get some employment. This is the kind of thing, the kind of pattern that had happened throughout the South. And the basic description of the welfare system that I have described makes the situation in the North not really fundamentally different. For it simply says that anybody who can work must work by simply not permitting them to have any welfare or making them go through 45 different certifications that there is no job available for them before they can get welfare. And then they are giving this totally inadequate subsistence level under such horrifying conditions that nobody would want to be on it for any length of time, and so that people will scramble to take any job that is available under any set of working conditions. And so the result is, you ask any welfare recipient, and a survey was taken in New York not long ago among welfare mothers, and 70% of those welfare mothers said that they wished they could have a job, and they wanted a job, and if they could only find a job, they would get off welfare immediately. I suppose the other 30% had either given up, or they may have felt that their most important job was to take care of their children, and they were willing to suffer the problems of welfare in order to be able to spend the time that they felt was needed with their children. The welfare rights movement, which began in Ohio with this protest march, and which was coordinated on a nationwide basis to develop a protest action on June 30th, 1966, got started with 16 simultaneous demonstrations at welfare departments or state capitals on June 30th, 1966. And the remarkable thing about these demonstrations was that poor people came out, they got together, they protested, and they found that their action was much more effective because it was coordinated with other actions that was taking place simultaneously in other parts of the country. For example, in every case, the welfare rights activity got major press coverage in their local community, whereas for the most part, welfare recipients had been used to having any positive actions they ever took ignored or relegated to the back pages of the papers. And the only time there was any coverage of welfare was when the taxpayers, so-called, were complaining about the fact that too much money was being spent on welfare, or when the newspaper was going on a crusade about some welfare family that they had found that was cheating the welfare department. I might mention, in relation to cheating, the incidence of cheating in welfare is much less than the incidence of cheating in the income tax system, in unemployment compensation, or in any of the other systems of aid programs or in subsidy or tax programs that there is in the country. It is much less. And that is not because welfare recipients are more honest than other people. It is because the welfare system is much more heavily policed than those other systems, and is much more heavily policed because, for all of the reasons I just gave about the public attitude toward ensuring that welfare recipients do not cheat. And the remarkable thing is, there is this tremendous hue and cry about welfare recipients cheating and the worry about welfare recipients cheating, and it is regarded as the normal thing when a politician cheats and gets graft. It is regarded as the normal thing when labor union leaders cheat and bilk their unions and their members for large sums of money. It is nobody bats an eyelash when Senator Eastland gets $150,000 a year not to grow any cotton. Nobody seems to worry about the fact that we have a highly subsidized aerospace industry, which is living pretty high off the public dole. Nobody seems to be worried about the fact that most of you in this room are living off the public dole. You are being subsidized by the state of Illinois to go to school. So all you people here are welfare recipients, living off the fat of the land in the state of Illinois. But nobody is saying you're a chiseler and a cheater. And is there a lot of examination of whether your income or whether you could be more profitably working than here in the school? There are probably many, many people here that oughtn't be here. You oughtn't be here. I used to teach in the university. And most of the students oughtn't be there, because the reason they're there is to get that credential to go out and get them some more money. And they had no more serious concern about education and about learning something than my dog has. And he doesn't have very much motivation. Now, the fact of the matter is, the mythology about welfare and the mythology about welfare recipients is simply because poor people are not regarded as important in the society. And the growth of the welfare rights movement and the basic thrust of the welfare rights movement is to organize and help poor people organize sufficiently so that we begin to have some political power. And when we have some political power, we feel that our needs will begin to be recognized as of a little greater importance. It is interesting, for example, that the congressmen and the senators who are advocating a guaranteed adequate income at the $6,500 level are the congressmen who come from districts where there are large concentrations of organized poor people, and where their tenure in Congress is quite directly connected to their responsiveness to that population of people. And I cite that only as an example of the fact that when you have some political power, your needs begin to be dealt with a little bit. And that we in the welfare rights movement are out to build some political power for some people who have not had political power, and certainly who do not have the economic resources. In the welfare rights movement, a very early decision was made that though the thrust of the movement among the organizers and among most of the recipients in the early days came out of the black community, that we would organize around the economic issues, and we would invite in Chicanos and Puerto Ricans and Indians and white people who were in the same economic circumstances. We did this for very pragmatic reasons. Since we wanted economic emancipation, and since there were many, many times more poor people who are white than there were poor people who are black, we could enhance our base and build a broader base of political power by developing alliance with all people who were poor and trying to involve all people in the movement. The significant thing was that at a time when a lot of people were saying that you couldn't do this, welfare recipients were out organizing as welfare recipients, and there began to emerge a movement which at the present time is composed of about 2/3 black people, about 20% Chicano and Puerto Rican people, and about 15 or 20% white and Indian people. And I might mention that the poor whites in the welfare rights organization is one of the most rapidly growing segments of the organization. They are not segregated within the organization, but the local welfare rights organizations are generally developed on a neighborhood basis in a very, very local area, usually in a public housing project or in a very small neighborhood. And so normally the neighborhoods will be in a ghetto or an area which is very heavily black or very heavily Puerto Rican or very heavily white. I might mention that we have organizations where there are both blacks and whites involved, in areas such as Indiana, in areas such as Appalachia, in areas such as Virginia, in areas such as Georgia and Texas. We have also in places such as South Boston, the area where Louise Day Hicks, a racist white lady, we have a very strong welfare rights organization growing in that area, and there is consideration at some stage that we may run a welfare recipient against Mrs. Hicks in one of the upcoming congressional elections. The welfare rights organization over the period of 4.5 years has built a membership of more than 125,000 people. We have now more than 700 local groups. We are organized in 400 cities across the country and in every state. We have built the organization around bread and butter issues that directly affect poor people. the kind of issue you heard Mrs. Easley describe, where checks were held up, and where recipients went down on an organized basis and demanded that those checks be immediately released. Or when somebody has cut off welfare illegitimately or illegally, we have demanded that they be put back on immediately. Or we have gone down on campaigns to get clothing or furniture or household goods that recipients were entitled to but who were otherwise denied. Or we have gone on campaigns to get free or reduced price school lunches, which people are entitled to in the schools but which they have not received. In short, we have organized around issues which affect money going directly to poor people. More money now for poor people has basically been one of the organizing slogans, and a guaranteed adequate income has been one of our most basic overall goals. We have organized, and our organized activity has created a major pressure on the welfare system, since by demanding and getting all that we are entitled to from welfare, and by demanding that every eligible person who applies be led on to welfare, and by publicizing the right to welfare and the right of people to get on welfare, and by protecting people from being illegally cut off welfare, we have helped and we have fostered the expansion of the welfare rolls that have taken place. In addition, our legal arm has worked to strike down arbitrary and unconstitutional practices and policies which have denied many people access to welfare. I cite the Supreme Court decisions on residence requirements and on man-in-the-house rule as two examples of very restrictive policies that have been stricken down as either unconstitutional or illegal under the Social Security Act. The result is that we at the present time have a situation where the country is faced with very rapidly rising welfare costs, especially in the AFDC program, and very rapidly rising numbers of people getting assistance. That has led, as I've indicated, to demands from governors for revenue sharing and for federal takeover of the welfare system. It has led to demands from the mayors and the city managers for the federal government to give them relief from the pressure, from the fiscal pressure caused by welfare recipients. The National Welfare Rights Strategy at the present time is to say, we do not want any fiscal relief for the states and the cities unless there is going to be fiscal relief at the same time for poor people. And fiscal relief for poor people means assuring poor people an adequate income to meet their basic needs. It is simple as that, and we are organizing to oppose in Congress any attempts to pass token legislation that does not deal with the basic problems that poor people have. Now, we expect, and we are beginning to encounter, repressive actions on the part of states across the country, here in Illinois, in California, in New York, in Rhode Island, and especially and initially in the state of Nevada. There have begun to be attacks on poor people and threats of cutting people off the welfare rolls or for cutting the meager grants that welfare recipients presently receive. The state of Nevada has moved against poor people by cutting more than 3,000 people off welfare entirely on the claim that they were receiving welfare fraudulently, and cutting the grants for another 4,000 recipients, claiming that they had inaccurately reported their income. NWRO sent a team of investigators, of lawyers, into the state, and we found that the state had flagrantly violated the rights of every recipient that they had cut off. They had failed to abide by a Supreme Court decision which says that a recipient is entitled to a hearing before their check may be cut off. They had failed to abide by a ruling that they are entitled to notice, to adequate notice, and they are entitled to know the reasons in writing before they are be cut off, because how otherwise can you know if you're being dealt with fairly or whether you're being dealt with arbitrarily? In every case where people were cut off welfare, those basic due process rights were violated in the state of Nevada. Furthermore, the reasons why people were cut off in most cases were quite obscure. The best we can tell is that people were being cut off for unreported income that they sometimes had 6 months or a year ago that is no longer available to them. And that income that the welfare department claims they failed to report, and now they owe it to the welfare department, and they're simply going to cut them off welfare until they have recouped the amount of money that supposedly the person cheated them out of 6 months or a year ago. Most of the ground, therefore, upon which people were cut off was very shaky. In addition, the welfare director, who is a prime candidate for president of the John Birch Society in the state of Nevada, decided that he was going to make himself a conservative hero in the nation by demonstrating to the rest of the states how you could eliminate or greatly reduce the welfare problem, thereby eliminating the recipients. And so not only did he cut the welfare rolls in this way, he went on nationwide TV and announced that 22% of the welfare population in Nevada was fraudulently receiving it, and therefore they were cutting them off. And he sent a memorandum to every governor and state welfare director in the country saying that perhaps they could cut their welfare rolls by a similar procedure. As far as we were concerned, this was the most massive attack on poor people that has happened since the welfare rights movement has been in existence. And our organization decided that we were going to take on Nevada head on. We therefore dispatched a dozen of our most experienced organizers into the state to help build up the welfare rights organizations there. We sent 30 or 40 of our top leaders in the country, went into the state for various periods of time to work with the local leadership and to help build up the power of the local groups to resist. And we recruited lawyers from around the country to come in and help develop legal challenges and to help recipients prepare to defend themselves legally against these cutoffs. The campaign, which we call Operation Nevada, has been underway for approximately 4 weeks. We have had several marches on the welfare department. We have raised demands that people be immediately reinstated and that George Miller, the state welfare director who perpetrated these actions, be immediately fired. We have had no response to our demands, and we have now declared war upon the Las Vegas Strip and upon the gambling casinos and the houses of prostitution which support the economy of the state of Nevada. We feel that the only way poor people have at the present time of creating pressure to change that situation in Nevada is to disrupt the economy and the economic interests of the Howard Hugheses, to disrupt the economy of the hotels and the gambling casinos that are profiting by a tourist trade in the state of Nevada. And so we are conducting marches and demonstrations in Nevada. We began this weekend with a march on the Las Vegas Strip of more than 1,500 people, or 1,500 people who were largely organized and mobilized in the Las Vegas area itself. The march was led, in addition to the welfare rights leadership, by Ralph Abernathy of Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Jane Fonda and Dave Dellinger from the People's Coalition for Peace and Justice, which is one of the new peace initiatives that is going into a spring offensive. And thirdly, by Dave Ifshin, who is president of the National Student Association. The campaign, which is now in high gear, is going to go on for the next several weeks and is going to go on until our demands that those people be reinstated are met. We marched and we took over Caesar's Palace on the Las Vegas Strip. We disrupted the gambling. We disrupted the hotel business for that weekend. And we intend to go back next weekend and not only march and disrupt the gambling on the strip, but we are going to conduct civil disobedience. We're going to block traffic if necessary. We're going to block the entrances to the hotels if necessary. We are going to conduct protests that actually interfere with the more drastically with the tourist traffic in that area. The following week, we will be holding demonstrations in Reno at a house of prostitution which operates legally there because there is an ordinance permitting prostitution in that area. We're going to demonstrate at the Mustang the following weekend in Reno. And on the weekend of the 26th and 27th, we are planning a major night march on Saturday night at the height of the nightlife on the Las Vegas Strip, with a massive coming in of people from all over the country to participate in that demonstration. I hope there might even be a mobilization on this campus where people who have time might come out to work in the campaign in Operation Nevada, and where people who are able might mobilize to come out on the 26th and 27th to participate in those demonstrations to help welfare recipients get their checks restored in the state of Nevada. I might mention that this campaign is supported by SCLC, National Student Association, and the People's Coalition for Peace and Justice. And it is being done as the opening round of the spring offensive against repression and against the war in Vietnam. The People's Coalition for Peace and Justice has declared this NWRO action as its opening round of a spring campaign. A spring campaign that combines the economic issues in this country and the repression in this country with a demand to an end to repression against poor people in Southeast Asia. This move is being begun with actions in Las Vegas to disrupt the strip and actions in Reno. It will proceed around April 4th with actions being basically organized by SCLC and NWRO at state capitals to protest threatened welfare cuts, to protest the fact that 18-year-olds do not have the right to vote. This is identified by SCLC as a major problem and a concern in a lot of the southern states and a thing that ought to be of concern to a lot of young people. We are organizing around issues such as capital punishment. We're organizing around issues such as the way in which the schools are administered, especially in the South. Finally, in May, we will be converging on Washington. For the end of April, there will be a major demonstration in Washington focusing on three basic demands. Number one, an end to the war in Southeast Asia and the immediate withdrawal of all U.S. troops. Number two, a $6,500 guaranteed adequate income. And number three, an end to repression against poor people here at home, and a freeing of all political prisoners. And we include, when we talk about political prisoners, Angela Davis and Bobby Seale and the other Panthers and people who are being detained. We are going to be demonstrating in May around these issues in Washington. We expect to have not only massive rallies and marches and lobbying, but we expect to have disruptive civil disobedience in Washington. And we intend to have massive actions in Washington and around the country until our basic demands are met. The National Welfare Rights Organization is participating in that campaign. We have come out flat-footed against the war in Vietnam and in Southeast Asia. We have come out for a withdrawal of the troops and are putting an emphasis on supporting life here at home rather than an emphasis on death and destruction abroad. We put an emphasis on ending the repression of poor people that subjugates us in a welfare system which is inadequate and unjust and destructive of human dignity and of human life. And we say that the emphasis in this country ought to be an emphasis on life rather than an emphasis on death. And our spring campaign, in concert with those other organizations, is to try to bring about a change in the priorities of the country from an emphasis on death to an emphasis on life. We hope that many of you will be joining in these campaigns in Nevada and as they come about throughout the spring. We hope that many of you will get involved in the struggle for life and in the struggle for hope and in the struggle for human decency, which is not possible without a guaranteed adequate income for all Americans. Thank you.